Okay, we're in 2 Chronicles chapter 16. King Asa of Judah, whom we know from our study, was a righteous man who walked in the steps of David, and at the end of chapter 15, the previous chapter, he told us about how Asa, his heart was perfect with the Lord all of his days. That word to be at peace with or safe with. We do read, though, that he committed an error in his judgment out of what is very evidently some pride that was there, that was in his heart, where he did not seek the Lord's direction in this matter. In chapter 16, in the first few verses of the chapter, where the king of Israel came and built a strong place on his border and posed that a great threat to him thereby. And so he went and made an alliance by paying money using the things that he brought out of the Lord's treasuries, and gave that to the king of Syria to break his alliance with the king of Israel and to then have an alliance with him. And so as a result of that, then the king of Syria then invaded Israel, and that relieved the pressure from Asa. But he made an alliance with this ungodly man. The king of Syria was not a follower of Jehovah, and he did not seek the Lord for the help in the situation. And so then we read in chapter 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verses 7 through 9, the words of a prophet that came to him, and then verse 10 records the response that Asa had. Let's read those verses again as we finish up there, and then we'll have the last few verses remaining, Lord willing, for this chapter and our overall look at the reign of Asa over Judah. So verses 7 through 10 here in 2 Chronicles chapter 16. Let's see, Brother Dave, can you start us off there?
At the time of Judah, the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said unto him, because thou hast relied on the king of Syria, and not relied on the Lord thy God, therefore is the host of the king of Syria escaped out of thy hand. Were not these Gobians and the Lubans a huge host of very little chariots and horsemen? Yet because thou didst rely on the Lord, he delivered them into thy hand. For the eyes of the Lord went to and fro throughout the whole earth, and showed himself strong, and the half of them whose heart was perfect toward you. Herein thou hast done foolishly, therefore from henceforth thou shalt have wars. Then Asa was brought to the seer, and put him in the prison house, for he was in a rage with him.
Okay, so this is the lowest moment, at least, that we are informed about in the life and the reign of Asa over Judah. He refers to Hanani here as the seer. That is a common word that's used. Well, what are the common words that we do see used in the scriptures for the Lord's prophets? Well, one of them I just used right there, a prophet. That one we see a lot. Man of God is a term that is used for his prophets many times. This is another one here, seer. And that means exactly that, one who sees. So why that term for a prophet? I think we can understand man of God, someone that God sent and inspired with his words to his people. Of course, a prophet by definition, is one who's speaking the Word of God. Prophecy, we tend to think of it in terms of foretelling the future, which very often came with what the prophets did, but it's not limited to that. 1 Corinthians 14, verse 3 in the New Testament tells us that one who prophesies is speaking to edification, exhortation, and comfort. So anyone that was inspired with God's words were prophets. And whether that was included foretelling the future, as they often did, but not every message from a prophet involved foretelling some future event. Now, this included that here. That was one of the ways by which God bore witness and showed that a one that he was inspiring with his word was indeed speaking God's words by foretelling something that would happen in the future, and then God would bring it to pass. That was because no man can foretell the future, in spite of those many who have tried or continue to. Only God can accurately, with 100% accurately, tell what's going to happen in the future and then make it happen accordingly, where there's no failure. And so that's one of the major ways in which we know one, or recognize one, who was truly a prophet of the Lord, as opposed to someone who was a false prophet that God didn't speak to. But we have this phrase here, this term seer. And why is that? Why is that a term for God's prophet? Yeah, that was the pattern by which God did give his word or speak his word to the prophets. The overall pattern was that God would speak to his prophets in a vision. Now, am I just making that up? No, better not be. But Numbers chapter 12 and verse 6, God here is identifying the pattern by which he worked with his prophets. And now Moses, he said he spoke to face to face, but he's showing what his pattern is with his prophets. Numbers 12, verse 6. Brother Ted, can you read that?
And he said, "Kill not my word, if there be a prophet among you. I the Lord will make myself known unto him in a vision, and will speak unto him in a dream."
All right, so there's the pattern that God identifies that he, by which he revealed his words to his prophets. He would speak to them in a dream. So it wasn't just that he gave them a vision of something, like they were watching a video, and then they just start speaking their own words about describing what they saw in a heavenly video. That's not what it was. What did God say? He would speak to them in a dream. He would show them something, and then he would reveal his words to them. They would hear God's words. They would then speak those words. So it was verbal. God would speak to them in those dreams. But when they were being inspired with his words, God very typically showed them something they could see. And those visions, these aren't dreams like we have when we're asleep at night. These are prophetic dreams, revelations from God when he would speak to them. But those visions and dreams that the prophets were shown when God would speak to them, those were very real. Those were very real events. I mean, we have some detailed accounts of them in some of the books of the prophets. Especially when you read the book of Ezekiel, there's a lot of detail the visions and dreams that God gave to Ezekiel. He would dig, God would carry him to Jerusalem. He would dig under the wall and see what was on the other side there in the temple in the vision. And I mean, those were very real experiences. Those things were, they were doing those things in those visions, seeing those things. Now, Ezekiel himself, his body remained in Babylon. But when he was given those visions, I mean, it was they were very real experiences, to the point we have an example in Acts 10, or chapter 12 rather, when Peter was relieved. Chapter 10 in Acts, Peter was given a vision when he was when God spoke to him and told him to go to the household of Cornelius. But then in chapter 12, just so we know that Peter, being an apostle and a prophet, one that the Lord inspired with his word, but revealed himself in dreams and visions too. So Peter was accustomed to that. So when God sent his angel to release him from prison there in Jerusalem, where he was being kept by Herod with the intent of having Peter killed very publicly and spectacularly on the Passover, God sent his angel to release him from prison. But when Peter got out and was led through the gate of the city, what was he considering? Is this really happening, or is God showing me? Is this one of these dreams? Is he? So then he came to understand this. No, this was not a dream or vision of prophecy. This was really happening. But that fact that he was questioning, trying to discern between the two, tells us how real those visions were for the prophets when they were given to them. But at any rate, that was the pattern. So since God revealed himself, spoke to him, these prophets, in dreams and visions, they were seeing these things that God showed to them when he spoke to them, then doesn't it make sense that he would describe prophets as seers, ones who saw those visions? So that's why he uses that term. I mean, this is an example of it here. So Hanani the seer. So did Hanani see things? Yes, he saw those visions and dreams that God showed to him when he revealed his word to him, spoke his word to him. So he sent this Hanani to Asa and rebuked him for relying on the king of Syria and not relying on the Lord. I mean, that was a choice there. Choosing to go to the king of Syria was a choice not to rely on God. Now, why did he do that? I mean, and we made a little comparison last week. We read that description of King Saul in 1 Samuel 10, 20 through 22, when God first had him called to be anointed as king of Israel. There he was. He was so timid that he was hiding among the stuff. He didn't want to be brought out before all the people. Well, five chapters later, 1 Samuel 15, 17 through 19, after Saul is rebelling against God and Samuel the prophet, that one who anointed him before, referred to when he was little in his own sight, which he obviously no longer was. There was a change that occurred in the heart of Saul, where he went from being little in his sight to not being little at all in his sight, being very puffed up, being very large in his own sight. He exalted himself. He became very proud. And that was, man, how is humility demonstrated? You know, we read these words and we certainly should recognize humility is part of the divine nature. Jesus was meek and lowly in heart, humble in heart. Matthew 11, and that's who we need to be like. That's the image we need to be conformed to. Humility is one of those parts of the love of God we must have in us. Pride is something that must be purged out. Pride comes before destruction, the haughty spirit before fall. We have to purge that out. Was there any pride in Christ? No. So we recognize that, and we see many scriptures on that, teaching us to be humble, teaching us not to be proud. But how do we see, or how does God define or demonstrate how humility is demonstrated? Well, we mentioned Christ. What passage of scripture describes the humility, just how much Christ humbled himself? Probably more than any passage, single passage, with that emphasis, making that point. Yeah, Philippians 2 and verses 5 through 8, when he tells us to have that same mind in us that he had. Well, where did he start? Being in the form of God. Did he think it robbery to be equal with God in form? No. But he made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. So he took on fleshly form, but when it says he made himself of no reputation, he literally emptied himself. He emptied himself of that form of God that he was in when he was with God from the beginning, and he emptied himself of that. He left that off. He came and took on a form of a servant, was made in the likeness of men, just like we are, fully of flesh and blood while he was here on this earth, made in all ways like we are, Hebrews 2:17. How many steps of humility is that to be in the form of God and then to willingly come and be like this? I mean, that's a long way down right there, isn't it? But then what did he do from there? When he took upon him the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of men, why was that necessary? James 1:13, can God be tempted with evil? In the form of God, could he be subject to temptation? No. When he was made in all ways like we are, again, Hebrews 2:17, according to Hebrews 4:15, what did that enable to happen? He was tempted in all points like as we are. Yet without sin. There's demonstration of his humility, as again Philippians 2 points out, after he took upon him the form of a servant, was made in the likeness of men. What did he do from there? He humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. So there was that humility demonstrated. He did whatever his father asked him to do. When his father asked him to empty himself of that form, John 1:1-3, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So he was with his Father, divine, in the form of God. And his Father asked him to empty himself of all of that and come here to this earth being made like this. He humbled himself. That's what his Father sent him to do, and he did it. And then when his Father sent him to this earth to live as he did, to be, not to be ministered unto, to be, but to minister and be the servant of all. That's what he did. And then when the Father's will was for him to be crucified on a cross, when he had done no wrong, to bear the sins of the world in order to accomplish the Father's will, could he take it any farther from where he started and what he did? Could you go any further down? So that obedience, that willingness to do everything his Father asked him to do, no matter what it was. That's the very description of what humility is about. Well, here's Asa. Now he's reached a point at this right now. He's being tempted. And we made this note, our point when we were looking at this last time. The devil doesn't give up trying to destroy us. And one of the things he can do, we move along in life, he's going to continue to keep trying to build whatever he can in our hearts that isn't good. Pride being one of those things. And he succeeded at this time with Asa. So he's after Asa. He's not letting Asa, that we're now down to, verse 1 says 36 years. So we're now in the last 5 years of his life, and the devil's after him. And he got him here in this situation. So he falls, Asa falls to temptations. Clearly it's involving pride. We see examples where we mentioned Joshua before, before the first battle of Ai, and also with the Gibeonites when he didn't take counsel of the Lord. He wasn't thinking in that moment, I need to ask the Lord about this. And even one as great as Joshua and as righteous as he was erred in that. So, there's some pride here. Perhaps he's not thinking, okay, now in this situation, I need to go to the Lord. But He should have known. I mean, he did know better from before. The example of when he faced the Ethiopians in chapter 14 was brought up by Hanani the prophet. So there's no excuse for him here. But he goes to this man for help instead of going to God. Now, on one level, it could be pronounced a success. I mean, what his ultimate objective was here was to have the threat from Baasha, the king of Israel, to be taken away. Well, did that happen? Well, yes. It wouldn't have happened if that had not been God's will. The way in which Asa went about it was not according to God's will. But God still allowed a benefit to come to Judah and even to Asa in this. Well, the king of Syria was ungodly, so was the king of Israel. So God would have his reasons why he wouldn't want Judah destroyed at this time. But the fact that God gave some benefit here did not mean that God was endorsing or showing that he agreed with or approved of Asa going to the king of Syria for help in this matter. Well, how do we know? What does Hanani point out? This really wasn't a success because what if Asa had relied upon the Lord, if he'd gone to the Lord like he had in chapter 14 when the Ethiopians came, what is implied here? What does Hanani the prophet say would have happened? Well, clearly, Baasha would God would have taken that away, but what else would he have done? I mean, was Baasha and the king of Israel, the northern kingdom, was that the only threat to Asa and to Judah? Well, no. I mean, what was going on here? What did Asa have to do to get the king of Syria to help him? He had to buy him off to break the alliance he had with Israel. Well, when he has already been an ally of the king of Israel, well, Israel is his enemy. So, I mean, what does that make Syria to Asa and Judah? I mean, he's a threat, an enemy. And what does God say through the prophet would have happened if Asa had relied upon the Lord? Not only would the Lord have taken away the threat, the problem he had with Baasha as the king of Israel, but also what would he have done? That's right. He would have gotten both of them. If he had relied upon the Lord would have delivered both into his hands. And so the two biggest enemies that he had would have both been taken out by God if he had just gone to the Lord for the help there. I mean, because you can ask the question, is it likely that Baasha would have been as emboldened to make this aggressive move against Asa if he didn't have the backing and the alliance that he did with Syria? Very unlikely he would have done that. So God was prepared to solve both those problems. I mean, how does Hanani describe God here and how God is working? We think about the devil and what the Lord tells about the devil and how the devil works. James 5, verse 8. What does he do? What is the devil doing? Through the whole earth. I mean, is the devil lazy? I mean, no. We would benefit greatly if the devil would just take a day off. I mean, if he would slack up and become lazy. But he's not. He's not lazy at all. I mean, he is busy and active. In fact, we read Revelation. From when Christ came, before Christ came, I mean, did the devil know about the Son of God, who he was, and what the Father's plans were with him? I mean, when Jesus came, how many of the devils acknowledged and openly stated who he was? And Christ would tell them to hold their peace. I mean, he didn't want who he was to be revealed by devils. He wanted it to be by his Father, like he did with Peter, Matthew 16. Blessed are thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed this unto you, but my Father which is in heaven. That Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Believe. He didn't want that to be revealed by flesh and blood, and he certainly did not by devils. That's why it was very rare that Jesus openly stated who he was. There were some times when he did, where it was necessary, and he had his reasons for doing so. But those Those occasions where Jesus, by his own mouth, stated exactly who he was, that he was the Son of God, that didn't happen very often. That was something that it was going to be the Father's work to make that known to those who were seeking him. And they would be able to identify that according to who Jesus was and the things that he was doing. For the devils to do that, that was not the will of God. And so Jesus would tell them to hold their peace. But how many times did they say, refer to him, call him the Holy One of Israel? You remember the one who had the legion, or the two actually, that were in the tombs over on the other side of the lake, that then they were referred to as legion. The ones that got cast out and went into the swine. They said, are you here to torment us before the time? I mean, they knew who Jesus was, they knew what his work was, and they also knew what was coming to them. How hard did the devil work to try to destroy all of that when Jesus, by trying to destroy Christ through temptation, trying to get him to sin right up to his last breath? I mean, he worked diligently to try to get him to fall, because that was really his only so-called hope. It wasn't going to work, but for Jesus to succeed, what was that going to do to the devil and his works? It was going to destroy that. And then you would have the way of salvation for mankind, the way to escape the devil and his snare. So all of that was going to, I mean, all of the devil's work was in jeopardy from what Christ was going to accomplish. So he was trying to destroy that. Once it happened, and when Christ was victorious, then and the Father raised him from the dead, well then, the devil's work, from that standpoint, is destroyed. So now, the next thing, up until that time, I mean, that was his only hope, to try to destroy Christ. But once that failed, now all that remains is for whenever Christ comes back. And the devil can do nothing to stop that. And he knows that his torment and judgment's coming. And so the book of Revelation describes this period of time in the New Testament age. The devil knows his time's running out. The next big event that's going to happen from his standpoint is when the Lord returns and this world ends. And then you're going to have Judgment Day. And then what's going to happen to him? I mean, that's who was hell prepared for? The devil and his angels. That's where he's going. There's quite a description of it there in Revelation chapter 20. Prior to that, of course, he describes the devil and his work. He's full of wrath, knowing his time is short. So he's not wasting a moment of it. I mean, his time is running out. So he's trying to use every moment to destroy as many people as he can. As many souls as he can before his own judgment comes. That's his inspiration. That's his motivation. So he's not wasting a moment. So he's going to and fro through the earth. He's like a roaring lion seeking me to devour. And his work is concentrated on God's servants. I mean, he's making sure that he's got the world deceived, but he does. They're in a snare. The ones that he's particularly motivated to get are the ones he doesn't have, us. There's his work. But when we think of the devil and how he's, and remember the description in Job when he appeared before the Lord, and how did he describe what he had been doing? Going to and fro through the earth and walking up and down in it. I mean, that's what he does. That's what he's doing. But we don't want to have the idea that the devil is the only busy one going through the earth. What is the description here of God by Hanani? Verse 9.
Going to and fro throughout the whole earth.
Yeah.
I'm so strong.
Is that important? The Lord, in his eyes, are going through the whole earth. He's looking at every soul. And now, we have a similar description of this in Psalms. In Psalm 14, also in 53, these same words are in both of these. What's that? Yeah. But Psalm 14, he's describing in verse 2 what the Lord is doing and what he's seeking for. Brother Allen, can you read Psalm 14, verse 2?
The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God.
All right, so what God is searching through the earth continually. What is he looking for? He's looking for those who are seeking after him. Does this tie into what we remember from Paul's sermon on the Mars Hill in Athens in Acts chapter 17? When he's speaking to those Athenians and they had been given over to all their superstitions and they had all their altars, including one to the unknown God. They wanted to make sure they didn't miss out on someone. So they had an altar to the unknown God. And so Paul said, him you ignorantly worship, I declare unto you. And then declares, he's the God of heaven that made all things, that made of one blood all nations on the face of the earth to seek him. And stated that he is not far from any one of us. So he's made us all, and he's made us to seek him. We can see there in that Psalm 14, too, he is diligently searching to see if any are seeking him, and he's not far from any one of us. And when God sees any, and he describes that in Acts 17, I mean, do we just suddenly one day snap awake with full spiritual sight? Oh, I have been in rebellion against God, and I have not been serving my Maker, and I need to do so. I mean, is it with just full from, you know, light, the light off and total darkness to, like, the switch just comes on and you see everything at once? I mean, is that how it is?
More analogies coming out of the train tunnel. It's more and more light.
Yeah. And it starts with that, as he describes it in Acts 17, as a feeling after him. And we know that experience when you are in the dark, maybe just a tiny bit of light. I mean, you're feeling around, trying to see where you are, where you're going. But you have an intent of where you're starting to, you know where you would like to go, and you start to see that, but then that becomes more and more. But what the Lord is seeing at the beginning in someone is not where they just are immediately, I know I have a Creator and I need to seek him. I mean, that's the point that it has to reach, but it's going to start with the feeling after him. But when that's what God's looking for, and if he sees somebody beginning that process when they're feeling after their Creator, they're looking in that direction, they're thinking about him on some level, how is he going to respond to that? He's right there. That's what he's looking for. He's not far from any one of us. And if he sees any spark like that, what's he going to do? He's going to respond to that. He's going to draw near. And he's going to be working with that person to try to fan that flame. He's going to be trying to work with them to see, to encourage more of that seeking. If they continue with that process, and that's where it's going to lead. If you seek, you'll find. That's the Lord's promise. Now, somewhere along that way, and they're seeing more and more, and they reach one, no, I'm just not willing to do that. I'm just not willing to do his will to that extent. Then, I mean, they're going to be, it's going to go the other way. Brother Michael?
Well, in Job, it says, you know, even creation is declaring his glory unto those that are seeking after him. I mean, but also in Psalm 91, heaven declares the glory of God, the firmament shows his handiwork. So, I mean, even if he has created beings, just look at the ground and see that, you know, he created himself, you know, there's some
which is why in Romans 1 he says no one has an excuse. He's made himself known by the creation. It's clearly seen. So he's not left himself without witness. He's done all this so that statement, there's a Maker, is just, it's hitting everybody right there in the face all the time. Who starts to think, well, wait a minute, I didn't put myself here. This didn't just happen on its own. Somebody made all this and made me. I mean, that thought process has got to come into play there. But it does start as that feeling after him. And one who seeks is going to find. God's going to respond to that. But we see that's how God is doing now. And one, as he's describing in the 2 Chronicles 16, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is perfect towards him. The more one seeks him, the more they're going to find, and God's going to draw nearer and nearer. And is God eager to bless and help the ones who are seeking him? And we need to remember that. It's not that when we do go to God and seek him and we're relying upon him, he doesn't regard us all as a bunch of pests. I mean, he teaches us to be importunate. He uses some examples of people who are pestering other humans, but God's not a human. And the way God responds to our being importunate is he doesn't regard us as a bunch of pests. We're not a big bother to him. He desires this. That's what he's looking for, he's describing there. God desires, he is eager to help and bless the ones who love him and are seeking him. And he was ready right here. He was looking at Asa, had a plan of what to do and how he was going to solve Asa's problem. All Asa had to do here was what?
Ask for the help.
He'd done it before, and what happened? But here, all he had to do was ask for that help. If he had gone to the Lord and said, "This Baasha is being a trouble to me, and Lord, please provide your help and deliverance as you're able." Just go back to what he said in chapter 14 when the Ethiopians came. And if he sought the Lord in the same way with those words again, what would have happened? God was right there ready to do it. But if we don't go to God, well, of course, we remember what he said in James 4, verse 2, when he says, "You receive not." What's one of the big reasons? He says you receive not because you ask not. I mean, the condition of receiving and finding and having him answering and opening the door is that we've got to seek to find. We've got to ask to receive. We've got to knock for it to be open. If we won't have enough faith to knock, to ask, to seek, I mean, is he going to give everything the same as if we did? No, it's a condition. We've got to do that. But this is a big lesson. We can look at this, what happened to Asa right here. We need to remember that. And we need to see this description of God and understand him and who he is and what his nature is like and how eager he is to be there for us and to draw near to us. And, I mean, that's greatly encouraging for us to never neglect to think about him and to seek his help in every situation in our lives. Now, is it always going to be his will to grant us things according to as we desire? No. What's that?
In James, that's what the point of the very next verse, yep. James 4, 3, is that you ask and receive not because you ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your lust. So our asking has to be in the proper manner in accordance with...
Yep. And then, and we always have to remember too. Of course, God, he sees and knows so far beyond what we can. And there's so many things that he's aware of and knows what is the best and right thing to do in every situation. There's so many things that we don't see, and God would have his reasons and sometimes it's a matter of time. I mean, Job was going through his process for months when we read those scriptures there. I mean, sometimes it's when you read that book, we might think, well, you know, all of a sudden he lost all his kids and all his possessions, and then whammo, he was sick, and then his friends come over, and there's a week of silence, and they all start condemning him, and then the next thing, God blesses him. Well, that's 42 chapters, but... That process after Job is stricken physically, we can read many of his words, and he says months, and he talks about how much his physical decline and the losing of his weight and the skin hanging. You know, this didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen even over a few days or even a few weeks. This went on for months and months and months. Now, Job was seeking the Lord in that, Job thought he was going to die and even asked the Lord, go ahead and take me out. And said the Lord wasn't hearing him. I mean, that's what he was pleading for relief and it wasn't coming. So in his mind, well, it wasn't God's will to give him relief. But it actually was. It just was not God's will to do it on the time frame exactly like Job was looking for. So we may think we're being told no or that God's not hearing or not responding, but it just may be an issue of our time frame and how fast we want what we're asking for. There's a lot of aspects to these things, as we know from the scriptures, Brother Young.
And there's
this
where the answer truly is no.
That, and where God has his reasons for that. Like Jesus, I mean, Jesus, when he asked for that cup to pass from him, if it was the Father's will, but he said, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. If it be possible, but it wasn't, according to the Father's will. And there were good reasons for that. So even God's Son was told no. In that case, for that reason. So yes, that's right. So sometimes it's a matter of time. Sometimes it is a matter of what God's overall plans are and what is necessary. And it, every time we get sick, is it wrong for us to ask for God to heal us? Now, at some point on this earth, Jesus doesn't come first. Is it going to be God's will that we don't get well for whatever is ailing us? I mean, if Jesus doesn't come first, we're all going to die, so there's going to come a point where it's not God's will for us to continue to get well and be here on this earth. We know that. So, there are a lot of things that we, factors that we can consider in that. But what he's teaching us here about God and his nature is that he is there, not far from us, and he's looking around and he's eager to help us and show himself strong on our behalf. Let's not make the mistake of not asking this one who has all of that power and has all of that desire to help us from doing what he's able to do. I mean, that's that when we're reading that, it really puts it into perspective how foolish we are when we don't go to him like we should every time. So there's that reminder there to Asa. Now, what would have been the proper response here? Oh yeah, I really blew that one. And then, I mean, he should have repented and said, I was wrong not to rely on him. And he should have been thankful to the prophet for reminding him of what this truth was and that he had not done right in this situation. Well, unfortunately, when the prophet told him he had done foolishly, and there was going to be a consequence to it, not only was he missing out on blessings that God had intended for him by not relying on him, but now he was going to get some problems that he would not have had otherwise. He was going to have wars to finish up the rest of his days. He was going to have conflicts with these other nations around him. So he missed out on blessings and he got troubles, all of which he could have avoided by relying on the Lord. So how did he respond to that? He got mad, the classic, he got angry at the messenger. Well, he didn't kill the messenger, he just put him in prison. But he's blaming the messenger here. He's mad about the words that he's just heard. Well, that's not a good response. Unfortunately, it's not a rare response, even from righteous people. If they fall into a situation and they're doing wrong and somebody points it out to them, I mean, is it a guarantee even a godly person every time their immediate reaction when they are told that what they're doing is wrong, that they're going to recognize that and be humble and be grateful to the one that pointed it out? Now, we should look at this and think about ourselves in that and look at ourselves in every situation to try to see what we need to do better. But if somebody's helping us out, we don't, that's not humility. This is more evidence of the pride here that had developed in Asa, that he has this reaction. We can see what a contrast that is to in 2 Samuel 12 with David. Now, David had done far worse in that matter that involved Uriah and Bathsheba. But when Nathan the prophet came to him and said, "Thou art the man," and then told him the child that Bathsheba was carrying then was going to die, that he was going to have, he was going to be in conflict, and there was going to be a sword dividing his family for the rest of his life. I mean, he was going to be plagued with troubles from his family, and all that happened. Could David have responded to Nathan in this way? The devil would have liked for him to, for sure, but he didn't. David immediately repented. So he humbled himself. Doesn't mean that every time somebody who's righteous, when they fall to a temptation and it's pointed out to them, that they're guaranteed to react like this. Sometimes they do. That makes it, instead of having one problem, now there's another one. So the initial problem that Asa had, now he's got this problem where he's persecuted a prophet, and it also says he oppressed some of the people at the same time. So there were some other evidently righteous ones that were around that recognized that what Asa wasn't doing was right and agreed with the prophet. So he was raging and going after all those that were opposing him at that moment in time. Now, based on the other statements that we have about Asa's life, can we conclude that Asa came around and recognized that that was that those actions were wrong and repented of that? Well, yes, because otherwise it wouldn't say that his heart was perfect with the Lord all of his days and that he walked in the ways of David. It would say that he went astray and then lost his soul in the end, and we'd be reading that, but that's not what we read. So even though he doesn't give the details of it, somewhere through this, before it was all over and done with, you know, Asa obviously did recognize that he was wrong in this, and not just from what first happened with not relying on the Lord, but then in his actions towards this prophet. So verse 11, we have the conclusion of his reign. But then at that, after that, he tells us one other thing. Let's read these last four verses. Let's see, Brother Eric, can you read 11 through 14? Second Chronicles 16, 11 to 14. So at the end, was Asa remembered, was he remembered well by the people of Judah for his life and reign? Yes, and for good reason. There are many acts that that involve this 41 years of his reign over Judah. He says they're written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. Well, we have this information, which is all the information. I mean, there was record of everything that involved his reign. We have this preserved, what we need to know of it, to learn the lessons that God intends for us to. Now, the other little thing that it mentions there in his 39th year, so this now we get down to the last 2 years of his life. And he's having health problems. And one problem he had was in his feet. Foot problems aren't very, aren't pleasant, are they, Michael? I mean, anybody ever had trouble with their feet? I mean, it's we rely on being able to walk around and do things, and that's one of those things that we can easily take for granted. We can just get up and take steps and go where we want to go and move like we want to, but whatever impedes that, that'll get our attention real quick. And then we become very appreciative of being able to do those things, and if we, especially when we can't do them. But we don't want to take all those taking of those things for granted. And but having problems like that in the feet, that's an unpleasant thing. This was an exceeding great disease that he had in his feet. We don't have the details of exactly what it was. There are lots of different things that can cause foot problems. We don't know what that was. But we knew, we do know that he made an error there in that he relied on the physicians instead of the Lord in that case. We got a little bit more to look at. I was hoping we would be able to close the rest of this out. We got a little... We have one tidbit we're going to have to hang over to next week, but is this, speaking of the profession of medicine or the physicians, that Christians shouldn't go to doctors? Is that the message from this, or that they shouldn't be doctors? No, that's not what he's saying there. Can God use physicians as a means by which he can help and provide relief? Yes, he can. We can look at that. But here was a case where he was not asking the Lord to use the physicians to bless him and asking the Lord to do the work. His trust was in the physicians, and he wasn't asking the Lord for the help here. So he's making another mistake. But we will look at a little bit of that for just a few minutes, Lord willing, next time at the beginning, and then go on into our study of King Jehoshaphat, Asa's son, when he becomes king over Judah. Brother Samuel, will you lead us in prayer as we close now?